So, welcome to, and I always get nervous when things line up. Like it's October 16th and it's lecture 16. That looks like a disaster is headed towards me. I don't know why. The lights will go out or the, whatever. Welcome to lecture 16, October 16th, lecture notes page 129. I just checked in with our dance team ladies, and they said, undoubtedly because of your help of voting for them, they won the grand prize and they're going to be supported in their April trip to nationals. Yay, thank you, thank them, whatever. All right, never mind. Thank yourselves. So here we are, October 16th, through lecture 16, as I said. The usual suspects moving along for the week. What do we know? We know that mini test 7 closed on Sunday. We continue to average 90%, and mini test 8 we'll open on the regular schedule tomorrow morning and run through Sunday, so nothing too new there. Enhanced learning extra credit number 5, still catching up from the fall break, will close this Wednesday, and 6 will open the following Thursday. So you guys know Birkenstocks. That's a thing we all know. Does anybody wear them, like Birkenstocks? Is that a thing here at all? Nobody likes Birkenstocks. Oh, this is the Birkenstock group over here. They're willing to admit it. So Birkenstocks just went and opened an initial public offering. So a key to Birkenstocks' billion-dollar success, its frumpiest shoe. Last week, Birkenstock clumped its way onto Wall Street with an initial public offering, IPO, seeking a valuation of up to $9.2 billion. The company's been around for almost 250 years. Who knew that? The 249-year-old German shoe brand. The actual IPO opened at 8.6 million, and its share value dropped it back to 3.4 billion, which often happens after an IPO rolls out. As it's evolved from a frumpy orthopedic sandal maker to a more than billion-dollar business, Birkenstock has received a boost from a surprising source: jaded sneakerheads, who have become smitten with its plump, closed-toed Boston clogs up on the left. So there's the impact of changing consumer tastes. I don't know if you immediately would leap to mind and say, who's the big target market for Birkenstocks? People have gotten tired of sneakers, but there it is. There's an infectious sneaker fatigue coursing through the streetwear world. The onslaught of new Nike releases and gotta have it Adidas have spurred many collectors to cry enough. The market, especially with Dunks or Jordans, is just oversaturated completely. People are looking for a different silhouette on foot, different feel, different comfortability. So sometimes a brand can offer too much of something and oversaturate their market. On StockX, Birkenstock is nudging its way in with the Nikes of the world. It is now the second fastest growing shoe brand on StockX, with particular demand for the Rubenesque Bostons, a shoe previously associated with hikers and health food store owners. Closed-toed styles like the Bostons make up over 20% of its total revenue. On Birkenstock's website, cork Bostons started at 120 bucks, so there's a price in the marketing mix. For example, Liz Ventner, 29, who owns a vintage retail business in New York City, purchased a pair of Boston clogs after seeing her friend's sister post her pair online. She got hooked and has worn the shoe nearly every day since. She also became something of an online mule evangelist, creating the TikTok videos and Instagram posts about how to style the Boston. So here we see the importance of social media and influencers to your brand in marketing. The social media generation has helped the orthopedic shoe brand shed some of its deadhead funk. According to the brand, 43% of its consumers are either millennials or Gen Z. So age cohort market segments being popular with the brand. Birkenstock's turn towards being fashionable has been helped in recent years by a collaboration tear, producing clogs and sandals with everyone, from the dark priest of high fashion Rick Owens to the streetwear pioneers at Stussy to the luxury powerhouse Valentino. So brand partnerships at work. By emphasizing collabs, Birkenstock has actually begun to behave more like a sneaker company. Haynes of StockX noted that with its attention-grabbing collaborations, Birkenstock is taking a page from the Nikes of the world. So we're getting consumers' attention with these collabs. Anybody know this platform, Via Via? Is that something y'all have heard of? It doesn't seem like it's that big, but it's in the news, so I'm sharing it with you. New Via Via platform hopes to change the way fashion brands sell to Gen Z consumers. Two Los Angeles entrepreneurs have launched a video-first e-commerce fashion website. They expect to be ahead of the curve when it comes to managing and selling merchandise to Gen Z shoppers. So we're seeing retail innovation of a sort, and we're seeing their target audience, their segment. It will have a streaming video to sell products, take care of orders and shipping, help designers source product and corral their product lifestyle, life cycle management, accessible at Via Live. The platform features a variety of brands, as well as Via Via's own private label collections. So here's the service value to their customers, doing all that stuff. Sujian Li, the company's chief executive, says fashion retail is undergoing a radical transformation, and Via Via wants to be at the forefront of this new transformation. Legacy wholesale retail platforms are grappling with the changing consumer behavior as the next generation is becoming more engaged and leaning on video for product and trend insights. Authentic creator-led video-first content is simply now not how legacy players are used to engaging with their customers. So here we see a platform, retail platform, responding to changes in consumer behavior. Via Via's multi-channel approach includes a variety of sales outlets with a focus on social commerce. The idea is that its international network of ambassadors and hosts, which include creators and stylists, assemble short-form videos and conduct live streams from all around the globe. So they're appealing to their target audience in a variety of ways. And finally, just popped up this, oh, not finally. In addition, Via Via is helping to manage the back end of its business. Brands can access Via Via's supply chain and product management tool called Elma. It's an AI-powered system that assists brands with identifying and managing global suppliers, reducing expenses, and decreasing production lead times. Elma continues to be the largest value add, Lee noted. It's a tech solution to build and manage future-proof supply chains for brands. So here's technology and business and supplier relationships. The sub-point here is, we said before, in the B2B world, if you can offer up a way to reduce expenses or increase revenue, you got their attention. Here, when you sign onto their platform, they're offering you a way to manage your expenses, manage your supplier relationships, increase your supply chain efficiency. That should be appealing to a bunch of brands, yeah? Finally, this I just heard coming in today. I think I heard it on NPR. Netflix is planning houses, quote, where fans can get closer to their favorite shows. Netflix is planning to open its first permanent retail locations by 2025. So this is a channel of distribution for them. Netflix houses will be a mix of entertainment and retail experiences where customers can eat, drink, and buy merchandise, and even attempt obstacle courses, like from Squid Game. Some of you guys watch Squid Games. Pretty disgusting and interesting at the same time, yeah? So I don't think they'd have exactly the things from Squid Games because you'd end up dead. But so here's their planned offering. We've seen how much fans love to immerse themselves in the world of our movies and TV shows, and we've been thinking a lot about how we can take that to the next level, said Josh Simon, Consumer Products Chief. So we're creating consumer experience in an age of experience, which we talked about in the first couple weeks of class. Other media companies have long used theme park attractions, costumes, toys, and other merchandise to promote their characters and create revenue opportunities. Netflix is new to this game, and it's been criticized by TV and film producers for not doing enough in that area. Management currently views Netflix House as a promotional tool rather than a significant source of revenue. So we're building fan relationships. We're getting them involved with these new bricks and mortar places. And again, on the side, we can also comment, it's interesting that how many bricks and mortar places have gone online, and now we have an interesting counter move, how many online places are moving into bricks and mortar. So things wax and they wane. They go up and they go down in the world of business. The pivot to live experiences comes as Netflix tries to maintain subscription growth amid price rises. The company told investors in July, we have more work to do to reaccelerate our growth. Netflix introduced a cheaper advertising-supported tier this year, as well as cracking down on password sharing. So the cheaper part of this is pricing decisions in the marketing mix. Subscription totals have rebounded since they dropped with the more expensive tiers and cracking down on password sharing since early 2022, when millions ditched the streaming service to stand at just over 238 million paid subscribers worldwide. An increase of 5.7 million subscribers from early in the year. So they're coming back. They're still viable. with that subscription base. All right, so on the lecture page 129, chapter 9, page 260 in the textbook, we're talking about STP. Anybody remember what S was? Guys out there remember what S was, anybody? No. Right, segmentation, they knew. T, right, targeting, good job. P, positioning, okay, so STP, and we talked about segmentation last couple times, and now we're coming around to the idea of target marketing, choosing a market segment for us to focus on. So that's where we're picking up with. So our last segment was Shane Dutka talking about a combination segmentation approach, geographic segmentation, building with awareness and their intentions. And now we pick up with traditional target market strategy. So STP, target marketing. So one approach, I'm being attacked here. One approach is market aggregation strategy. It's also called mass marketing or undifferentiated marketing. So in this approach, we're not making much use of our segmentation work. We're just looking out there. We're going to try to blast something out to everyone and hope we hit somebody with something. So it's a single marketing strategy for everybody. In these days of people getting shot, probably the best imagery is not a shotgun approach, but the point is we're not really targeting much. We're just blasting out there and hoping that we hit somebody with our marketing mix. So it's pretty uncommon. I mean, even a commodity product like gasoline has different segments, right? What are their segments? It's up there on the screen, but what are the segments for gasoline?
Regular,
yeah, high test, extra high test, right? Or diesel, I guess would be another thing, but you know, even gasoline has a segmentation approach. On the other hand, and I don't know if anybody's ever gonna call me on this one, what's your favorite, well, first of all, what is that thing over there? Clothespin. What's your favorite clothespin? I don't know. So I'm not too sure. There are a lot of segments for clothespins. We make a clothespin, we hope somebody buys it, sort of logic. So what are some advantages of this approach to, if you will, target marketing? Well, one thing is you're going to have lower costs. Again, if we're taking operations management at all, we know that operations, production, loves long production runs of the same thing, right? You get great economies of scale. You get great expertise. We know what we're doing. We're not stopping and changing over to a different size or shape or color or whatever. It's a long production run. And long production runs lower your per unit cost. So you don't have to carry a lot of different inventory. You don't have a lot of changeover costs. And it's easy to manage. What are you managing today? Clothespins? We're done. So those are some advantages. A different approach is some form of product differentiation. Product differentiation involves using different elements of the marketing mix. What are the four P's of the marketing mix? What's one of the P's? Price, product, promotion, place. We got it if we have everybody together in one room. Product, place, promotion, using some element of the marketing mix or elements to do what? To help consumers see the product as being different from the competition and, of course, better for them. So we're now going to use product differentiation strategy. For example, to create a perception that the brand is better than PCs, Apple has used a successful differentiation marketing strategy, trying to make people feel that Apple has a better product for consumers than PCs. Within this idea of product differentiation, we can use a single segment strategy or concentration. Here we do the work of segmentation. We do look out there and we find different groups of people who share needs, wants, values, attitudes, buying behaviors, etc., that make them different than other people. We talked about that under segmentation. And we consciously choose one of those groups, not everybody, to focus on. So it's a concentration strategy. So we have one marketing mix that does target a defined group from our segmentation work. So we're not blasting out at everybody. We have one group that we think works for us. This can be a good way to avoid competition. In the old days, this car company came to America, and they did not want to be crowded out by the big three. Of course, the car company was Volkswagen. And what did they call their initial entry? What was that called? Nobody has the name for it. The Beetle, the Bug, okay? And for years, every year after year after year, Beetle or Bug looked pretty much the same. You really couldn't tell much difference. They were not interested in making them big and making them fancy and having convertibles, having trucks, etc. They were had a little niche of people that wanted inexpensive cars, and that was their niche. Now, things do change over time, so certainly they become a little different, and today you can get all kinds of VWs out there in the world. So they shifted their strategy over time. Ferrari, though, continues to concentrate on their original single segment. They're not making pickup trucks and SUVs and low-end models for the starter for the starter buyer. They still have a single segment concentrated strategy. Now, what's an advantage of this? Well, as a marketer, you can build a reputation as an expert or a specialist in that niche market. So I assume if we were talking really fast sports cars, one brand name that would come to mind, I presume, would be Ferrari. They're sort of an expert in that area. Volkswagen does not leap to mind when we talk sports cars. Now, niche markets are often small, though not always. So you have to keep that in mind if you're focusing on a particular niche. Anybody happen to be a paintballer or ever play paintball? A couple guys play paintball. Does it hurt? If you're a paintballer as a serious sort of hobby or sport, you probably know the Spider brand. They've been bought out, so they're now Spider Fenix. They're paintball specialists. Spider has a passion for paintball. They're part of the Core family. All that is paintball. Let's see if they're still active. So whether you want the gun or whether you want the gear, whether you want the ammo, these guys are going to have it for you under the Spider brand. So it's a sport. It's a hobby. For people that don't want to get beat up, low impact, kitty. So they have a large range of things targeted to paintball. That's a pretty selected niche market, right? It's a sport, it's a hobby. What, name any other sport. Basketball, okay, who makes basketballs? Who comes to mind? Spalding, okay. Does Spalding do other sports other than just basketballs? Wilson? Sports, they do a boatload of things, right? They're not really big in paintball, and paintball companies don't really have to worry about going head-to-head against Spalding in the bigger market. They've chosen a niche, and they're doing really good work for that segment of the marketplace, that niche. So it's one way for a firm with limited resources to be competitive. You don't have to worry about trying to make snowshoes and baseball bats and hockey pucks and hockey masks. You're just doing stuff related to paintball. Now, one problem is you are indeed putting all of your eggs in one basket. What would the risk for a paintball niche company be? What might happen? What could happen? Goes out of style. People are tired of being hurt by paintballs, or somebody actually does get really hurt and it becomes a big blow-up deal and they legislate it out. So you do have all your eggs in one basket. So for example, if the basket breaks, all your eggs are gone. Here's my little imagery here. Who remembers the World Football League? Okay, how are they doing today? They're not. Oh, everything was in one thing, one basket. They're gone. How about the DeLorean car? You guys remember the DeLorean car? Yeah? What movie was it in? Back to the Future, how's it doing today? It's a collector's item, they didn't play out. Orbitz soda, not a thing anymore. So, yes, you can focus on a particular niche and you may be very successful, but you have to be aware everything's in one basket. If that basket drops, the eggs break. So let's take a different approach to the world. Let's back up to our segmentation strategy. Let's do the work. This group wants fashion. This group wants luxury. This group wants low price. This group doesn't want anything to do with us. So we have different segments out there. Can we satisfy more than one segment at a time? Can we satisfy multiple segments? So we identify multiple segments that could work for us. We develop, market, and manage multiple marketing mix offerings, and we attempt to satisfy the needs, wants, and desires of each segment with a targeted marketing mix. So I've given who I am. I developed something that's really special for that fashion group, and something else that's really special, I forget, for the technology group, and something else that's special for the low price group. And they're not going to overlap. These guys don't want what those guys want. Don't want what those guys want. And those guys don't want anything to do with us. So we're going to see what can we do to selectively do really well in each of these market segments. For example, Bayer Health Company. What leaps to mind? Well, I don't know if all these leap to mind, but Leave, Midol, Bronchate, Citrical, Aspirina, Fergon, Rid. All of these are different segments that Bayer Company deals with. What are some advantages? Well, we can eliminate or reduce seasonal demand. When you imagine you play paintball, what time of year? Summer. I don't imagine paintballs feel very good after they freeze in the wintertime. Now they're lethal, right? So I don't know what you do in the wintertime if you're a paintball manufacturer, yeah? On the other hand, Spalding, man, they got sports products all times of the year. Dorm rooms, when are dorm rooms not used? In the summertime, what are we going to do? We still got costs, we still got bonds to pay off, we still got expenses, and nobody's using dorm rooms in the summer. Whoops, that's not good for us. Become well known in the product category as a leader. So you get Wilson Sporting Goods, pretty well known across all of the sporting domains. On the other hand, man, you got a mess of inventory to deal with. You got baseballs and baseball bats and hockey pucks and hockey sticks and masks and clothing and gear and basketballs and on and on and on and on. So imagine the costs of running that kind of inventory and having adequate inventory in your supply chain of all the colors and styles and shapes and sizes. Also, each one of these segments requires a separate appeal. Fashion, technology, low cost, it's not the same thing. So now you're ramping up promotional mixes, probably through different channels of distribution, probably with different influencers, probably with different messages to these different things. That ramps up costs. And if these folks shop in different places, your distribution costs become quite expensive. Because you got to have one for the tech fit folks, one for the high fashion folks, one for the low cost folks. So you better be sure you understand this, and you have to make up for all these costs with what? Strong sales, with strong profitability across these different segments. For example, it's estimated that it costs, takes $100 million in annual sales to support each new version of Crest toothpaste that rolls out. That's a lot of tubes of toothpaste that you better be selling when you come up with the whitening version and the gingivitis version and the breath mint version, etc. So you better understand those segments pretty well. Urban Outfitters, you guys know Urban Outfitters is a brand? They run across a bunch of different segments. So they're a lifestyle retail company, operates retail clothing stores. It operates through two reportable business segments, retail and wholesale. The retail segment consists of Urban Outfitters, Anthropology, that's the word. I always put an extra syllable or two. Anthropology, Free People, Terrain, Leaf's Daughter, and Beholden Brands, whose merchandise is sold directly through stores and catalogs and call centers and websites. The wholesale segment consists of Free People Division. It designs, develops, and markets young women's contemporary casual apparel. So let's take a look at one of these. Urban Outfitters targets young adults, men and women, ages 18 to 28, through unique merchandise mix, compelling store environment, websites, and mobile applications. That's their target audience, one segment of the population. Not really speaking to me as a segment, but perhaps it is to those in the 18 to 28 target audience. Anthropology Group consists of Anthropology, Beholden, and Terrain brands. Anthropology's target market is affluent women between the ages of 30 and 40. So we see a little income-driven segmentation. We see a little demographic segmentation, women and age-driven. The individuals who want to reflect their unique style with what they wear. The brand goes beyond the surface and considers their target customer as a friend. So if you're paying attention to the models and the look, it's a little different than that first segment was. A little more formal, a little older. Beholden brand emphasizes every element contributes to a wedding. The brand offers a curated collection of heirloom, quality wedding gowns, bridesmaid frocks, party dresses, assorted jewelry, headpieces, footwear, lingerie, and decorations. We have a variety of segments that these folks are targeting with clearly different mixes of products, price ranges, and ads. Terrain designed to appeal to women and men interested in creative and sophisticated outdoor living and gardening experience. Terrain's product offerings include lifestyle home, garden and outdoor living products, antiques, live plants, flowers, and wellness products and accessories. And Free People. Free People is targeted to young contemporary women aged 25 to 30. A specialty women's clothing brand is a destination for bohemian fashion that features the latest trends and vintage collections for women who live through free fashion, who live through fashion, art, music, and travel.
Going out of my head.
So, in order to set this up, you have to understand the needs, wants, and desires of these different segments and figure out the marketing mix that's going to appeal to them. And more, Nuuly, our subscription segment consists of the Nuuly brand, which is a monthly women's apparel subscription rental service. For a monthly fee, Nuuly subscribers can select rental product from a wide selection of the company's own brands, third-party labels, and one-of-a-kind vintage pieces via a custom-built digital platform. Subscribers select their products each month, wear them as often as they like, then swap into new products the following month. Subscribers are also able to purchase the rented product if they really like it.
Nuuly is a way to get creative with what you wear every single day, in a way that's gentler on the planet and your wallet. Every month, you can rent any six styles for $88 per month. Try new trends, experiment with your style, flex your fit, all without breaking the bank. It's about discovering something new, loving something you never expected, and surprising yourself in the best way possible. It's less wasting, more wearing, less spending, more value, less owning, more options. Nuuly, more life in your clothes.
And menus and venues. The menus and venues division focuses on a dining experience that provides excellence in food, beverage, and service with 11 restaurants in the U.S. what an interesting array of different segments for a particular company to focus on, each individually, differently. But that's a little expensive to keep running over time as you focus on all that different stuff. This is probably a little overwrought, I guess, but I'm talking about segmentation in almost a commodity product, jeans. At the broadest level, what would you imagine the segmentation might be, really broadly for jeans? Two big segments. Yeah. Women and men is obviously, not, but you're exactly right, the biggest sort of difference between the two. But then, of course, we have segments within each. So in men's, we can have them fit by loose, regular, slim, by leg, boot cut, skinny cut, straight, tapered. You can buy them at places like Sears. Yes, Sears is still a place, mostly online these days. How much should I pay for a pair of Levi's jeans at Sears, would you say? Any ideas? $63, $58, $60, $59. Does that sound about right, price-wise? Nobody buys jeans? Say again? Yeah, okay. Just curious what a pair of jeans runs these days. All right, and then we have Kohl's as another outlet. And I imagine we're going to see a similar sort of price there. This is always the risk of going off to real live sites, but let's see what they got. Jeans. So $59, $69, $79. Okay, well, that looks like what we're paying for jeans. All right, cool. Nordstrom. So price point about the same for jeans at Nordstrom? $59. We don't know. Nobody shops Nordstrom. Sue, my wife, would you imagine the same price at Nordstrom for jeans? Yeah. As Kohl's? No, maybe not. So here's Levi jeans at Nordstrom on their live site. Wait a minute. I thought we just decided jeans, you know, $58, $68. Now we're at $98 for a pair of jeans. They're Levi's jeans. Wait a second. Now we're up to $108 for a pair of jeans. They're Levi's jeans. All right, so what are we learning a little bit here? We're learning that even jeans can be segmented by the store outlet you're in at different price points. Jeans. And then we got women, by waist, after waist, high rise, just below waist, road rise, ultra low rise, by leg, skinny, straight, boot cut, flare, trouser. Anybody know Armani jeans? They're jeans. Sexy, relaxed, active, stylish. Those are not going to be $59, though. So what are we going to pay for these guys? $645, $895. People are smiling. I can see you want some. $595, $745. So jeans are not necessarily jeans. Now I admit Levi's, you know, Armani's are Levi, but still, they're jeans. And I don't know, True Religion make it? They still around? They used to be pretty expensive. I'm not sure what's going on with that. They're back to a prick point. They're back to a lower price point. So the question, of course, is, here the question when I put this together was, how can jeans cost $300? How can they cost $900? How can they cost their jeans? But different segments of the marketplace want different stuff from their jeans, and people make it possible. Or if you like, we can do mass customization for you. You can make your own jeans. Jump out to makeyourownjeans.com. How many people have problems finding the right fit? You know, here, there. We can make a pair for you. So, trying custom jeans for the first time. Here's our guarantee product fit. So we're gonna, if you're a man, we're going to get you all set up step by step through ordering the jean that you want. And hey, they're pretty reasonably priced. Or a little more expensive. Custom-made jeans from Sledgeworks. And we're going to handcraft your denim jeans. This is not a mass market approach. nor a fast approach. No, you're not going to work with me here. Well, they're out there, but I'm not going to wait for them to come up. You'll just have to trust me that this guy's going to sit there and handcraft your genes for you. So which gene segment are you in? Yes, dear, I know you're in the Nordstrom, I know. All right, so there we go. So let's think about this idea of segmentation target marketing at the B2B level over at Timken.
We've segmented markets in a lot of different ways. The way that we're focused on primarily today is by, I'll call it industry. And so our whole business is focused on, as an example, primary metals, wind energy, power generation, cement, automotive, off-highway construction vehicles. And so we kind of divide the market up by how our product gets used and in the kinds of equipment and applications our product gets used. And within those market segments, then we can divide up the market even further, and that's the real challenge of marketing is this micro marketing or micro segmentation to really understand within off-highway construction, as an example, are there customers that demand short lead time production? Are there customers that need longer life? Are there customers that are looking for more productivity? And again, going down to that level and trying to develop products and service offerings around that is a real challenge. It's actually been a very big focus of the Timken Company since about 2004. We've had a strong focus on strengthening our marketing capabilities in those areas I just talked about.
So he talks about micro-segmentation. The point, of course, is that each of these micro-segments could represent a target audience that we would focus on. And he's saying, look, this is the trick. These are not very, you'd have to be very smart to figure out these broad segments. But now, given your business, what about the micro segments, those little target markets that you could focus on given who you are, your skills, et cetera? That's where it takes a little research, a little business slash marketing chops to make it work. So B2B world, segmentation and target market. Over to the B2B side, we mentioned Bayer a little bit ago. Bayer employs over 100,000 people worldwide. They're active in more than 83 countries. They're over sales of over $53 billion. They have more than 170 brands worldwide, and their over-the-counter brands are manufactured around the globe. So let's look at their five major segments. They do analgesics. What are analgesics? What's another word for analgesic? Nada? Nothing? Nobody? Say it again? Yeah, thank you. Pain relief. So they do things like Bayer aspirin, Aleve, acrinimidol. Gastrointestinal segment, so they have a bunch of products here, Alka-Seltzer, Lifax, Philips Milk, Magnesia, Rennie, and Talcid. They also do dermatological segment. They do cough and cold remedies, and they do multivitamins and dietary supplements. Burocan, One A Day, Flintstones, Complete Gummies, my first Flintstone. Some of you guys grew up on Flintstones. Some of us, yeah. All right, that's Bayer, which might not be obvious. They do have a variety of segments. Now, within aspirin, they have two major target audiences, two major segments, aspirin regimen and aspirin for pain relief. So, if you've had a heart attack, stroke, or you're high risk for that, they want your doctor and your medicine want you on a regular regime of low dose aspirin. It thins your blood, keeps it from clotting, keeps you from getting another stroke or another heart attack, or at least not being so severe. So within this, then, they have women's and sugar-free and chewable and different flavors, etc. So again, broad segments, narrow segments, micro segments of things to appeal to. And they have aspirin for pain relief, back and body, Bayer Plus, Bayer PM, extra strength. And of course, we have ads targeting these folks.
Body pain? Oh. Back pain? Try Bayer Back and Body. It's Bayer aspirin plus a special pain relief booster to relieve sore backs and soothe aching muscles fast. Get moving again with Bayer Back and Body.
An ad specifically targeted to one of our target audiences. Now, people can be confused over time about exactly who you are.
Do you have something for pain?
I have Bayer aspirin.
I'm not having a heart attack. It's
It's my back?
I mean Bayer Back and Body. It works great for pain.
Bayer Back and Body provides effective relief for your tough pain.
Better?
Yeah. Thanks for the tip.
So this poor guy, when he thinks Bayer, what comes to his mind is a positioning of a heart attack or a stroke. No. I just need something for my back. So you have to be careful what image you're leaving with the consumer. He was a little confused by everything. So what are some tips on selecting a target market from all those choices out there? Well, you have to decide of those segments, micro segments that you defined, that you researched, that you found out, how desirable is each one of those? First of all, is it compatible with your goals? You remember my silly example of Patagonia? The guy comes in, he says, we found a market for an exploding piton. Blast it into the mountain face. People love it. Well, maybe they will, maybe they won't, but it's not consistent with who we are. We're not going to do that, no. Do we want to sell alcohol, for example? Do we want to avoid selling our product to discounters like Walmart? So is the particular segment we're talking about, where's my low-cost segment? We don't want to sell low-cost products. We're wiping you away. You know, with luxury and technology, people don't want anything to do with us. Is there a match between the market opportunity and our resources? Do we have the management talent to do whatever it is? Do we have the production facilities to do whatever it is? Can we reach the people with our marketing mix, with our promotion, with our sales staff to do whatever it is? Is there a match between our opportunity and our resources? Black and Decker bought GE's small appliance business. They had an interesting question. How and where should we market our small appliances? Should we market it in an appliance store, which we're not very familiar with? Should we market it over where we sell our Black & Decker products? Well, where are Black & Decker tools sold? Places like the Home Depot. And so they initially rolled it out selling Black & Decker coffee makers to places like the Home Depot, and then eventually grew it to other places as well. But it was consistent with the way they were used to selling their tools. Also, remember, we're trying to discover and satisfy consumer needs, wants, and desires at a profit through an integrated effort of the firm. So given what you've just turned up, is it going to be profitable? Because we said it's expensive to wrap all this stuff up. Can you make a profit? Segment has to be large enough in terms of numbers of people or numbers of businesses, in terms of the dollars that they have to spend. Now, in the B2B world, large enough might be 100 businesses. You probably are not going to be very successful in the B2C world if you have 100 customers. So is it large enough given what we're talking about? Is it expected to grow? Probably it's not a great time to try to open a blockbuster franchise. I don't think they're really going to grow. So is your segment going to grow? I've already sort of touched on this. We need to be able to reach the segment with our marketing mix, with our product, with our advertising at a reasonable cost. Otherwise, it gets too expensive. way back in the days of the dot-com bubble, everybody was going to be a dot-com company, and a company comes up with an interesting idea. I'll reveal the story. What I'm going to tell you in a minute, they crashed and burned big time. Years later, they've come back under a new idea. But the company was Webvan. Webvan was an online credit and delivery grocery business that went bankrupt. They were operating in 10 U.S. markets. Webvan delivered products to customers' homes within a 30-minute window of their choosing, and they had originally hoped to expand to 26 cities. They didn't have any partnerships, though. Webvan was going to do this all on their own. They were going to set up the distribution centers. They were going to set up the delivery. How many products are in a typical grocery store? I forget what we said last time we chatted about this. 30,000 different colors, I don't know, a whole bunch. How much is it going to cost these guys to set up warehouses in 26 cities close enough that they can deliver in 30 minutes to anybody in those cities? It was ridiculous. So what happened? The cost of processing, fulfilling, and delivering was $500 million. You got to sell a lot of stalks of celery and cans of soup to make that make sense. Realistically, they could not reach their target consumer with the promise. And so Webvan came and went. Now, obviously, years later, grocery store chains themselves are doing delivery. Amazon is doing what they couldn't do years later. But in the day, it just didn't make sense. They couldn't afford it. It was too costly. So DoorDash expanded so that customers can now order groceries on demand from the local Southeastern grocery store, delivered in as little as 45 minutes through DoorDash's marketplace app. Uber Connect is now available in 6,000 cities and towns, working with established grocery stores and restaurants. A host of instant delivery startups, Joker, Biker, 1520 Fridge No More, Gorillas, Getar, promise extra fast convenience store style products directly to city dwellers' doors. The companies say orders will arrive in 30, 20, 15, or even 10 minutes after customers hit the buy button on their apps. But they're not setting up their own warehouses to provide all this stuff. They're working from existing storefronts. Also, you'd love to go where competitors are few and or weak. You don't want to go up against Lipton Tea. You don't want to go up against Wilson Sporting Goods. So given your choice, find some place where there are not a lot of competitors or they're not very strong. Now, having segmented the market into various groups, analyze them to determine which and how many of these to target with your appropriate marketing mixes, we next need to think about how to position our brand for our target audiences. So segmentation, targeting, positioning. The idea of positioning the product is the idea of creating and maintaining in the minds of our target market consumers a particular image relative to competing products. In my little, I guess not really silly example for Bear, the guy in the airplane, when he said Bear aspirin, he was misperceiving it as only being for heart attacks and strokes. The positioning was too tight for him. Oh yeah, we can also do back pain. For example, anybody other than me like Sensodyne toothpaste? A bunch of other people? And let me say, I really like Sensodyne. When my wife goes out and buys Minty Crest, ooh, no, don't do that. It hurts my mouth. Sensodyne is well positioned for what it is. And what is it? Sensodyne toothpaste, as its name implies, its benefit for its consumers, sensitive teeth and gums. The ads that it creates focuses on those benefits.
Having the sensitivity, they want to get rid of it. They want to be out of pain. There's no reason to put up with the pain of tooth sensitivity. I recommend Sensodyne to my patients. Sensodyne helps with the sensitivity, plus it's great for fighting cavities, it freshens your breath. With proper brushing, it can help with your gum health. Sensodyne is definitely at the top of my list. It works and it always delivers, and my outcomes are always good. What a difference that makes.
So sure, it does the basic thing a toothpaste has to do. It cleans your teeth, yes, but it does that extra thing. It helps reduce the sensitivity of your tooth to the toothpaste, and it adds dentist recommendations. So it's not just some ordinary toothpaste out there. It's one that's recommended by a dentist. Wow, we're positioning this brand in the mind of the consumer. Consumers often form mental images to simplify their decision making, and by positioning our product in their mind, we want to help them to do that. So when you think toothpaste, for you, you want Sensodyne. So how do we go about positioning the product? Well, first, we have to determine what the positioning concept is going to be based on what's important to the target consumers. Think back to last week when we were talking about what do people want in a wellness center. They were quite different things, if you can recall. What do your consumers want? Do they want to be social? Do they want to improve their sports? Do they want heavy weightlifting? What do they want? So what will you do for your consumer that other companies or products are not going to do? That they want. I need to keep emphasizing that, that they want. So A complaint from some consumers is, you know, ordinary soap leaves my skin feeling dry and tight. Well, gee, what can I do for you to help you out? I can create Dove. Dove contains 1/4 pure moisturizing cream and mild cleansers that leave your skin soft and clean and smooth. That nasty soap stuff, on the other hand, contains drying ingredients that strip skin of its natural moisture, leaving it feeling dry and tight. Use Dove.
We offered women a mystery beauty treatment.
Right now? Yeah, that sounds great.
Could they guess what it was?
It's very rich and smooth, really creamy.
I keep touching my face.
So, what had we used?
What?
Wait!
Just water was added to this?
My skin definitely feels much more radiant.
That sense of having, like, smooth, dewy skin.
Only Dove has 1/4 moisturizing cream for smoother, more radiant skin. Dove, your daily beauty treatment for radiant skin.
Okay, we're not talking about a soap to clean your hands after a hard day's work out in the field, right? Dewy skin. I probably need some of that, right? So, they're positioning their brand. Second of all, having established what it is that your consumer really wants and values in that target audience, figure out what features are going to convey that position. 1/4 cleansing cream. Help your sensitive teeth. Done well, whatever that thing is your unique selling proposition. USP, as we talk about in business. So sensitized, unique selling proposition, well, they really help your teeth be less sensitive. Dove's unique selling proposition, well, 1/4, whatever it was, what is it, 1/4 moisturizing cream. Your USP differentiates your product from the competition, and it does so on a feature that is key to the consumers. If you don't find the thing that's key to the consumer is just something you liked, you liked it in your product, nobody cares. It doesn't differentiate. You're not successful. Examples are having the lowest cost, if that's what your consumer wants. Works great for Americans, but as we found out when we talked about international or global, didn't work well for the Japanese, for Walmart. They didn't care for the low-cost option. Wrong feature. The highest quality, or being, for example, the first ever product of its kind. Some people like to be innovators. A USP can be thought of as what you have that competitors don't have that is of importance to your consumers, that matters to them. And this is why my wife shops at Nordstrom and I shop at Kohl's. We have different needs, wants, and desires when it comes to clothing products. So each of those has a different thing than the other competitor. Step three, then, now that you understand all this, is to coordinate all the elements of the marketing mix to convey that position to the consumer. Your product, your price, your place, your promotion all have to pull together in the same direction. So there's a single message that consumers get when they think about your brand. So, I don't know, target, expect more, pay less, could be their positioning concept. The USP score. The toughest job you'll ever love, a positioning for them. M&M's melts in your mouth, not in your hand. FedEx, the world on time when it absolutely positively has to get there. Bounty, the quicker picker-upper. Brands that have taglines that are supposed to reflect who they are in their product and their place, and their product, place, price, and promotion on things that they believe are important to their consumers that help position the product in the minds of their consumers. Kay's Jewelers. What comes to mind when you think Kay's Jewelers? Do you know their tagline? Every kiss begins with K, right? So a positioning that actually comes to your mind as you think of them.
What's that? You got Mommy a Mother's Day present? From where?
Oh, nice. Oh, I totally agree. She is the best mommy ever.
It's beautiful.
But that, what's that?
Give Daddy a great big kiss.
Every kiss begins with kiss.
Little romance, probably affordable. I mean, Tiffany's they're not, right? But it works for that certain younger population. They want a little light romance in their lives. And sometimes what we need to do is find ways to reposition our brand. It worked for a while. Consumer taste change, competition changes, whatever. We have to reposition our brand. Victoria's Secret is the largest lingerie retailer in the U.S. and has been for several decades. 2022, their total revenues were $6.3 billion, fair amount of lingerie. Victoria's Secret is a fashion retailer known for its lingerie, sleepwear, and beauty products. It achieved explosive success in the late 90s and the 2000s, but it has been accused of losing relevance in recent years as societal norms and consumer values change, which is what happens in the real world. Things change. The brand faced criticism for its use of overly sexualized marketing and for not representing a diverse range of body types in its fashion shows and advertising. In 2019, as criticism grew, the company announced it would no longer be hosting its annual fashion show, which had been a major event for the brand. The decision was made in part due to declining ratings and negative backlash surrounding the show's lack of diversity. You have to pay attention to your consumers. In 2020, its revenues were $5.4 billion, dropped down from what they had been, so the impact of changing social norms on them. In recent years, the brand has attempted to reposition itself and focus on a more inclusive and diverse image. In 2021, with this change, they're back up to $6.8 billion in sales. So this seems to indicate a positive impact of understanding the consumers, understanding how their values change, repositioning your brand over here to where the consumer now is. In 2020, the brand also announced that it would be discontinuing its swim and apparel lines and focusing on lingerie, sleepwear, and beauty products. Also made efforts to be more inclusive in their advertising and marketing campaigns, so they featured models of different sizes, skin tones, ethnicities, and also made an effort to feature more realistic and diverse images of women in its advertising. In general, brands need to understand and represent the diversity of their customers and adapt their marketing as changes occur in their target audience. Today's consumers want to see themselves reflected in the marketing of companies whose clothes they wear. What happened during the time period when they were not paying attention? Dropping the ball, that is, not focusing on the changing norms of their consumers, really gave other brands the opportunity to move in. Their biggest competitor is Aerie at American Eagle, and they're the ones who really pioneered the body positivity movement. Direct-to-consumer lingerie brand Third Love, in particular, has based much of its marketing on being anti-Victoria's Secret. With its repositioning, Victoria's Secret plans to regain their lost market and seem to be working at it. A product positioning tool that we use in the real world, and I just wanted, I'm behind the curve a little bit. Kent has just run, literally, a perceptual map of its brand against the competition. I'm going to go off script here and not make it testable, and don't reveal this to anybody else, because this could be top market secret marketing advice for all I know. But their perceptual map, in general, has two important dimensions. This example, as you can see, is about fashion, limited service, extensive service, fashion forward, traditional. And we put the brands on the perceptual map to see where the competition is and it isn't. In the case of the most recent marketing campaign coming out now from Kent, their research showed one dimension was on prestige versus humility in advertising and positioning for the universities. And the other was a focus on programs and institutions, or focus on people. So that was their perceptual map. Kent, in that map, was sort of down here, which is to say, towards humble in their ads, and a little bit towards people. Ohio State. I'm trying to think who else was up here. Ohio State, maybe Ohio University, maybe Miami. These guys were all in the area of prestige, but focused on the institution. So there's a whole grouping here. It was folks down here. And I think the only person right where about Davey is was Penn State. The rest of this area was open. And so their new marketing campaign, don't tell anybody, is going to be in what on their perceptual map was an empty quadrant that they thought would work well. So the new campaign is going to be more prestige, but more focused on people rather than the institutions per se. And the notion, as you can see, is you pick the positioning where you're not going to go head to head against existing competition. That makes sense for your target audience. You're now in on the inside. So anyhow, in my example, the two dimensions were fashion forward traditional, limited service and extensive service. And so you can see there are places where there are unoccupied positions, where nobody is operating. So would you really want to go into that upper right quadrant in my example? You want to go head to head against Macy's, Bloomingdale's, and Nordstrom? Probably not. So now the question is, given these open areas, did any of these make sense for us? So with your target audience in mind, you select a positioning concept that's valuable to them and that differentiates you from competition. In my example, could you go fashion forward with less service? Could you go somewhat traditional with moderate service? What unoccupied position would make sense for you and your customers? Second of all, given what you've thought about, design the dimensions or the features that most effectively convey the position. How are you going to communicate that position that you've chosen? Your brand name, your price, your distribution, your ads. And then coordinate those marketing mix components to convey a position, consistent position. All of your marketing mix elements have to complement that intended position, or else consumers become confused. So you're trying to build that image in their mind. And of course, that assumed that you followed my advice on picking a good segment, picking a good target market. So you can underposition your brand. What's that mean? Your stuff is not all pulling together in the same direction. People don't quite understand who or what you are or what you represent. So you don't position the brand very well. Crystal Pepsi was that idea of a crystal clear product that tasted exactly like Pepsi. What is that? And why would I want it? What is it? KFC lost their way for a while. They came back a little bit. What did KFC used to be called? What did it stand for? Kentucky Fried Chicken. For a while, they got away from that. They decided that fried was not a good idea to have out there, so they shifted from Kentucky Fried Chicken to KFC. Wait a minute, I thought you were fried chicken. And then they lost for a while the use of the Colonel. The Colonel sort of went away. The Colonel was the emblem of who you are. They came back a little bit, but Crystal Pepsi, KFC sort of drifted away. They didn't position their brand very well over time. Or you can overposition. You can give buyers too narrow a picture of your company. How many of you can imagine shopping at Kay's Jewelers for a piece of jewelry? How many of you can imagine shopping at Tiffany's? Well, there weren't that many shopping at Kay's, but nobody can picture shopping at Tiffany's. Why not? It's got to be too expensive. How much would a ring be at Tiffany's? How much? Say again? $1,000? That sound about right for a ring? Something like that? Well, obviously, I'm not shopping at Tiffany's. I'm a college. No? You're saying no? Too much or too little? Too much? So how much do you think a ring at Tiffany's might be? Oh, thousands and thousands of dollars. So $1,000 is too little. It would cost a lot more, which is why I'm not shopping there, right? So whatever it is, I'm pretty sure that Tiffany's in the gorgeous little blue box is going to be too expensive for me. So I'm not going to shop there because that's the image that I get when I think of Tiffany's. Well, let's see how much things really are. How about a nice little romantic something? I don't know, romantic? So, yeah, looks like you're right. 14,000? Probably not shopping there. This is supposed to sort, by the way, on the fly. It's supposed to sort low price to high price. Where's my sort here? Huh. Well, now? Is it on the right somewhere? Sort by? No, they messed with me since last time I was here. Hold on. What I'm trying to do is make the point, if I can get there in less than 20 minutes, that you can buy products. How about here? How about low to high? Low to high? All right. So here's a little pendant for $190. Here's a little cute blue heart for $260. It jumped up pretty quick. Things have gotten expensive since the last time I was here, making a liar out of me. My point was, it's not thousands and thousands of dollars. How's that? So it might be possible to find something that you could buy for a few hundred dollars. Wow, prices have gone up. Obviously, I'm not shopping here anytime soon either. Yeah. You're killing me now. So it's perhaps expensive, but not as expensive as we thought it would be. So we might, by example, we might block ourselves out from a certain segment by over-positioning, being too tight on who we are, or confused positioning. Consumers can't make out what you are, who you are, how do I use you, what do I use you for? So why would I buy you? I don't know what you are. For example, when you think Velveeta, who knows what Velveeta is? What is Velveeta? Cheese, sort of, a block of cheese. Do you use it for cooking? Do you use it for snacking? People weren't exactly clear on what it was, and it wasn't their go-to product in a lot of cases. So in 2021, they realized this problem, and they debuted the La Dolce Velveeta campaign. The goal is to pivot Velveeta from a cheese-adjacent product, sort of cheese, to a lifestyle brand. Good luck with that. The campaign is all about stepping out in a confident, unapologetic way to show the world you're living a life filled with outrageous pleasures like Velveeta cheese. The target, therefore, is pleasure-seeking fans who aren't shy to flaunt their good fortune with their Velveeta cheese choice. Dolce Velveeta. I don't know if it worked for them, but they were certainly trying to reposition their brand for a certain consumer set. What are some basic positioning platforms that you might go for? Well, one would be the premium position or the status symbol. Do you guys know the brand name Stuart Hughes for any reason? Is that a brand anyone knows? You know, no, you're just writing something. All right. Stuart Hughes is an interesting, unique company. They're in the luxury fashion situation. So here is a jeweled tuxedo you can get for 600,000 pounds. That's more than that in dollars. You can get an Apple phone in titanium and black diamonds, that's for $30,000, et cetera, et cetera. It's a real company. People actually spend money there. And their positioning is obviously premium or status. Maserati, all right, again, not your beginner car. So an extraordinary model range. Others just travel. You, however, travel in a Maserati. I'm looking for, well, you can see this is pretty special. Or what about value for the money? The opposite of a Maserati. How about something like a nice 2024 Mini Cooper or a Kia Rio, a different position in the marketplace? How about being known as a friend, a family value, somebody that brings warmth to the community? Basham's Grocery. A family-owned and operated grocer that began back in 32, their mission, provide excellent service, deliver their personal best, exceed customers' expectations, offer quality products at competitive prices. We strive to grow and improve our business with a focus on the needs of our consumers. We're committed to the betterment of our communities through service and support. We're family, we're friendly, we're warm. Problem solver, IBM. Fun? Disney. Trendy or stylish? Oscar de la Renta or Zara. You could be a role model, or you could have imagery like reliability or trust or quality or celebrity endorsements. I don't know what that click is. David Beckham unveiling his new menswear range for H&M as a celebrity endorser, or anti-establishment and rebel, or a technology legal, or a service leader. And these are simplistic, so they aren't independent from one another. You can cross over. Obviously, Disney is fun, but it's also family-oriented, so you can have your positioning span more than one platform. So segmentation, targeting, positioning. Key concepts in doing business and doing marketing. Have a good day. This is the end of the material for Mini Test 8, which will open tomorrow. Bye.